Ayatollah Khamenei describes the poisoning of schoolgirls in Iran as an unforgivable crime which deserves maximum penalty. The presidents of Iran and Russia discuss the expansion of bilateral relations in a variety of fields. And Bangladesh launches an investigation into a massive fire in a Rohingya refugee camp that has left around 12,000 people without shelter. Hello and welcome to World News, coming to you live from our international studios right here in Tehran. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. Now, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has urged officials to seriously pursue the cases of schoolgirls poisoning. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei stressed that the incidents would be unforgivable crimes if they're proven to be poisoning attacks. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei was referring to the cases of schoolgirls who were poisoned in several schools over the past months. The incidents have occurred in a number of cities, mostly in the central city of Qom. An unspecified number of students have been hospitalized. Now, the leaders stress that the perpetrators must be given capital punishment if the incidents turn out to be poisoning attacks. President Ebrahim Raisi has already ordered the ministers of the Intelligence and the Interior to follow up on the case. Interior Minister Ahmed Vahidi has reported the discovery of suspicious samples at affected sites. Iran's Health Minister Yunus Panahi says the suspected attacks were aimed at disrupting the girls' education. Well, the presidents of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Russian Federation have discussed the expansion of bilateral relations. In a phone call, Ebrahim Raisi and Vladimir Putin assessed the developments in the Tehran-Moscow ties as positive. Now, they hailed boosting bilateral cooperation across various sectors, including energy and transit. The two also discussed the implementation of joint infrastructure projects, including the International North-South Transport Corridor. Now, the project is aimed at carrying transit cargo from India, Iran, and the Persian Gulf to Europe via the Russian territory. The phone conversation is the third between the two presidents since the beginning of this year. Well, Iran has pledged to keep the flow of information on its nuclear program to the International Atomic Energy Agency. But the country says that would be within the framework of the Non-Proliferation Treaty and the Safeguards Agreement. Now, the pledge was made by the director of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran. Mohammad Islami said Tehran is committed to cooperation with the agency. He also said Iran won't give in to Washington's maximum pressure campaign and attempts to pressure the country through the UN nuclear watchdog. Islami also talked about the 2015 nuclear deal and said Iran rolled back its commitments because of the delay tactics by other parties to impede a consensus. His comments come a day after a visit by the IAEA chief to Iran. It led to an agreement under which Iran voluntarily allowed the agency to conduct more verification and monitoring activities in the country. And now to Bangladesh, where fire in a Rohingya refugee camp there has destroyed scores of facilities and some 2,000 huts. Around 12,000 people have been left without shelter. We've discussed the issue in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
A massive fire rips through a Rohingya refugee camp in Bangladesh, robbing around 12,000 people of their shelter. Flames swept through the Kutubalong camp and gutted some 2,000 huts before it was brought under control. 90 facilities, including hospitals and schools, were burnt down as a result. Bangladeshi authorities are yet to release the number of casualties. They say that an investigation is underway to determine the cause of the fire. An estimated 1 million Rohingya Muslims live in the world's largest refugee camp in Bangladesh. They escaped to Bangladesh in 2017. After a genocide by the military in their homeland, Myanmar. Sayyid Mohsen Abbas is a journalist and political commentator joining us from London. And we have Ahmed Uddin, who's a human rights activist, also joining us from London. Welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas. It's unfortunate, the plight of the Rohingya refugees overall. And of course, this incident just adds really fuel to the fire of their unknown destination. They're living as refugees in Bangladesh. Tell us a little bit more about the failure of the so-called international community when it comes to their plight, because obviously Myanmar is not going to come to their rescue. And, well, Bangladesh has done what it can at this point.
Well, the thing is that, as you say, it's yet another example of how the international, if you like, bodies are completely useless in most regards. I mean, what three of the ones that I can think of in this instance that have supposedly been trying to take action to help the Rohingya. One is the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, which filed an international lawsuit at the International Court of Justice. And all they've really got so far out of it is a court ruling to say that the Myanmar government must take preventative action. But any real sanctions or anything like that, or any real ruling, won't take place for years. The ICC, the International Criminal Court, also has simply just started an investigation, which seems to have gone under the radar. Of course, there isn't a great deal of interest. There's not a great deal of financial gain to be had out of the Rohingyas and their plight. So it doesn't really immediately come on the agenda of the usual suspects which talk about human rights, namely America and the Western imperialists. And of course, they've seen the ethnic cleansing that went on. They've seen the genocide. Literally 6,000 or 7,000 Rohingyas were killed in the first 1 or 2 months of the August to September 2017 genocide. And of course, they all know about the exclusionary nature of the citizenship laws there. They know about the Buddhist extremists, the far-right nationalists, which have been persecuting these people for decades. And of course, there's been a decades of government and official systemic discrimination, racism, etc. And these people have basically no legal documents in Myanmar now. Statelessness is just part of their norm. Targeted violence and impunity of the security forces, you know, who can get away with anything they like, is also a norm. Now, you know, there are, so many, 1 million to 300,000, I think, in Bangladesh alone. Those who are left in Myanmar are under serious threat on a constant basis. And half of those in these camps, which are being now burned down, goodness knows what really is behind that, their children. And I think it's an absolute desperate state.
Ahmadudin, taking a look at the plight of these Myanmar, these Rohingyas, it would be ideal for them to go back to Myanmar and for there to not be this discrimination against them, which, based on the past, some have called genocide because of the troubles that they have experienced there from the Buddhist monks, as it were. But that seems to be a remote, if not not a possibility at all. There needs to be some kind of integration either within the society that they're in, or something needs to be resolved in order for them not to go through what has been called, obviously, the largest stateless number of people in one setting. What movements forward can be made on the plight of the Rohingyas?
It's a collective effort needs to be made, because the reality is that there's over 1.2 million Rohingya in Bangladesh alone. The Rohingya diaspora is also spread up in places like Pakistan, India, and places as far as Malaysia and Indonesia. And there is no there's no guarantee that if they did return back to Myanmar, whether they face kind of continued persecution, because the current, Syed mentioned earlier on, that the current population in Rakhine State, the Rohingya, are facing kind of discrimination and are fear of their life. And so many have been trying to leave the state to neighboring Bangladesh, but have failed to do so, or died en route in the sea. The problem is that those countries, especially Bangladesh, have taken on the responsibility of taking care of the Rohingya. But Bangladesh alone, who cannot kind of take this responsibility on, there needs to be an international effort to solve the issue at hand. At the moment, the United Nations has said that there is a massive shortfall when it just comes just food alone. They're saying that they've reduced 17% of the food that's going into the camps, and there's going to be a further cut in this April because there's a shortfall of over £100 million. That's just food alone, and we're not talking about the hygiene, we're not talking about shelter, we're not talking about education. any of that, even the trauma they face, the mental health assistance that they need, none of that has been attended to the way it should be. And so there needs to be a collective effort, there needs to be collective pressure on Myanmar, and to kind of, to first of all, Myanmar to recognize the fact that Rohingya are people of Myanmar and have been in that area of Rakhine State for many generations.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Thank you. Ahmadou Dean, human rights activist there from London. And Sid Mohsen Abbas, thank you, a pleasure, a political commentator there from London. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
At least 9 police officers are killed and 16 others wounded in a bombing attack in southwest Pakistan. The bombing targeted a truck carrying paramilitary forces in Quetta Baluchistan province. A suspected bomber rammed his explosive-laden motorbike into the vehicle. The death toll is expected to rise as the injured officers are reported to be in critical condition. Shortly after the explosion, the Taliban in Pakistan claimed responsibility for the attack. Now, the group has been blamed for a string of bombings and other terrorist attacks in Pakistan recently. Officials say such attacks have surged since August of 2021, when the Taliban took power in Afghanistan. Nasser Kazmi earlier told us about the Pakistani government's measures to prevent terrorist attacks. Let's take a listen.
This was the second attack in less than 2 weeks as the similar explosion occurred in the neighboring city of Mostung last week, and more than five civilians were killed in the attack. This was the massive attack on the Pakistani security forces after the two attacks which took place, one in the southwestern Karachi province and then in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces, respectively. The government is trying its best to co-opt the situation at the moment, and we have seen that the Pakistani delegation led by its ministers went to Kabul and raised this issue of terrorism with the Afghan leadership, and Pakistan asked the Afghan authorities to handle those militants which are said to be hiding inside Afghanistan, especially these Tehrik-e-Taliban militants, which are close aid to Afghan Taliban at the moment. However, we have seen that the insurgents are active in Pakistan and they are carrying out attacks inside Pakistan in various cities. So Pakistan is trying its best, while we have seen that the security has been enhanced in all porous borders with Afghanistan, especially in Balochistan and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces, respectively.
The South Korean government has agreed to compensate the victims of forced labor under the former Japanese Empire. That's an attempt to remove the issue of compensations as a major hurdle to the normalization of ties with Tokyo.
As part of the support for forced labor victims and their family members, the Foundation for Victims of Forced Mobilization by Imperial Japan will pay compensation and delayed interest to the plaintiffs of 3 Supreme Court decisions in 2018.
The foreign minister described the move as a window of opportunity and a last chance to overcome hostility with Japan. He also urged Tokyo to offer a comprehensive apology. South Korea has time and again pressed Japan to compensate the survivors and families of its occupation between 1910 and 1945. Around 800,000 South Koreans were conscripted into forced labor by Japan during that period. Meanwhile, the Japanese foreign minister has welcomed South Korea's decision. The minister reiterated, however, that Tokyo stands by a 1998 declaration on the issue.
On this occasion, the Japanese government confirms that it continues to hold the same understanding of history as previous cabinets, including on the 1998 Japan-South Korea Joint Declaration.
Hayashi also said the new plan will help restore healthy ties. South Korea's Supreme Court had earlier ordered the Japanese companies to pay the compensation for forced labor. The U-turn on the ruling has sparked a backlash from victims and South Korea's main opposition party. They accused the government of capitulating to Japan. Well, the TikTok saga goes on. Beijing says the true intention of Washington is to deny China the technology and to further assert its hegemony.
is accustomed to politicizing, supplying, and weaponizing economic and trade science and technology issues under the guise of national security, with the real purpose of depriving China of its development rights and maintaining its own hegemony.
The spokesperson made the remarks in response to TikTok being potentially a target in an upcoming U.S. bill aimed at banning some foreign technology. Mao added that the U.S. banning of TikTok violates the principles of market competition and fairness and seriously undermines the international economic and trade order. Washington is expected to introduce legislation this week aimed at banning or prohibiting foreign technology products such as TikTok. Now, the White House has already ordered American federal agencies to remove the application from devices operated by their staff within 30 days. Canada and the EU have also banned TikTok. Hundreds of Austrians take to the streets of Vienna to protest against weapons delivery to Ukraine and the American business of wars. The protesters call for Austria's neutrality, stressing that delivering weapons can never bring peace. They also slammed the European Union's policy toward the war in Ukraine. They added that Austria's membership in the bloc has forced the country to support what the Union decides. Several European countries have seen rallies against Western arms flow to Ukraine since the start of the war last year. The U.S. and Western allies have provided billions of dollars in weapons to Ukraine so far. And with that, brings us to the end of this at Worldless edition right here. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Food tourism. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember in the previous episode, we briefly talked about a few foods in Kordkui region of Golestan province and made you familiar with the simple recipe of one food and one halva. In the fifth episode of this series, you will get familiar with the edibles of Turkmens as a big ethnicity in Golestan province. Stay tuned, please. Turkmens are originally from Central Asia and have lived as migrating tribes. They live in vast areas including Turkmenistan, parts of Russia, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, and northeastern Iran. Turkmens speak in Turkmen language and form almost 2% of Iran's population, 1.5 million people. Turkmens of Iran live mainly in the southeast of the Caspian Sea, which straddles a vast region of Golestan province. Turkmens have a rich culture which is manifested in their customs, clothes, handcrafts, music, and foods. The beautiful clothes of Turkmens and their handmade ornaments attract every viewer. Turkmen music is also unique. The main musical instrument of Turkmens is called tamdire, which looks like the smallest type of dotar. Turkmens are Sunni Muslims who respect God's bounties and pay high respect for foods, especially bread. They sit on the ground around a tablecloth and say Bismillah, or in the name of God, before starting the food. At the end of the food also, the elderly, usually the father, recites verses of the Quran and thanks God, while others say Amen. Some of the most famous Turkmen foods are çektirme, katlama, börek, çörek, pişme, and susme. Stay tuned to get familiar with çektirme. Çektirme is a very popular Turkmen food which is made during parties, wedding, and mourning ceremonies. It has also attracted travelers and tourists. It can be prepared with meat or fish. In continuation of this episode, you will hear on çektirme with meat. The following are ingredients for making çektirme for three people. 3 measures of rice, 350 grams of fresh ground meat, 250 grams of grated tomato, a middle-sized onion chopped in very little pieces, 2 spoonfuls of tomato paste, salt, oil, pepper, and special spices as much as needed. Now, if you want to make this çektirme, listen to this recipe. You should have a cast iron or zinc pot. First, wash the rice and soak it for a few hours in lukewarm water and salt. Pour a little oil in the pot and put it on mild fire. Pour onion when the oil is hot and let it be fried a bit. Then add turmeric so that the smell can be felt. Now, pour meat pieces in the pot and let them fry. Then add salt, pepper, and rice spices and stir them well. Then add the grated tomatoes, and once the tomatoes are dry, add tomato paste and fry it. Next, add 2.5 measures of water and let it be cooked on mild flame. This phase usually takes 2 hours. Then add the rice and pour enough water. Now let çektirme be cooked on mild fire. After half an hour, your delicious çektirme is ready. Çektirme is usually served with local yogurt, camel duk. Duk is a mixture of yogurt and water. Shirazi salad, raw garlic, or garlic pickles. Dear listeners, the Coast Bazaar of Bandar-e Turkmen or Turkmen Port on Gorgan Gulf is an appropriate place for promenade and buying Turkmen handicrafts and clothes. You can find fast food like börek, susme, and pişme too. Bishme is a kind of traditional sweet of Turkmens. To make this sweet, you need 2 glasses of sweet yogurt, 1.5 glasses of milk, 3 glasses of sugar, 2 eggs, 2 spoonfuls of baking powder, 1/4 of teaspoon of vanilla, 3 glasses of flour, and enough oil. And now the recipe. First, stir eggs and sugar and add yogurt and milk. Then add flour, vanilla, and baking powder. To give a better color to the sweets, you can add some saffron. Then leave it in a pretty warm place. 20 minutes later, flatten the dough as thick as one joint of finger. Then cut it into little pieces. You can make it in different shapes with different frames. Finally, fry the little pieces of dough. Remember that the dish for this sweet should be deep so that oil covers the dough and the sweets become puffy. Don't forget that the flame should be mild. Make this tasty Turkmen sweet and enjoy it with your family.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا O you who believe, اِسْتَعِينُوا بِالصَّبْرِ وَالصَّلَاةِ
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
When we use the word Mahdi, this is basically, you know, this concept of believing that somebody will make an appearance or he will come before the end of time to establish the kingdom of God on this earth. This is the belief in the messianic figure, you know, where you will have, inshallah, you know, total and true peace and justice in the society. This belief in a Mahdi who will come at the end of time, who will make his appearance at the end of the time, is not only a Shia belief. This is actually a unanimous belief of all Muslims. Right from the Wahhabis on the one extreme to the Shia Isma'asharis on the other extreme. And all different groups in between, Sunnis and Sufis and others. And when there is unanimity among all the Muslims about the concept of Al-Mahdi, you know, there can be no room for any, you know, idea, oh, this is bid'ah, this is shirk, this is ghuluv, because then you are going to paint the entire ummah as mushrik and ghali. Let me give you three quotations here. Number one, starting from Ibn Taymiyyah. Ibn Taymiyyah is a scholar of the 7th century of the Islamic era. It is his ideas which are the foundation of the Wahhabi madhab. All the scholars of Wahhabism, they look at Ibn Taymiyyah as their thinker, as their mutakallim, as their theologian. In a book that he has, Minhaj al-Sunnah, multi-volume work, talking about the ahadith which have come about al-Mahdi, he says, وَحَدِيثُ al-Mahdi ma'rufa. Is that the ahadith about al-Mahdi are very well known. It has been narrated by Ahmad bin Hanbal, by Abu Dawood, Tirmidhi, and many others. And then he gives an example. For example, the hadith of Abdullah bin Mas'ud. Abdullah bin Mas'ud was a very prominent companion of the Prophet. He quotes his hadith as an example, where he says that the Prophet said, لَوْ لَمْ يَبْقَى مِنَ الدُّنْيَا إِلَّا يَوْمٌ لَطَوَّلَ اللَّهُ ذَلِكَ الْيَوْمٌ. If in the age of the and the term of this earth only one day remains, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is going to prolong that day حَتَّى يَبْعَثُ فِيهِ رَجُلًا مِنْ أَهْلِ بَيْتِ, until he raises a man from among my Ahlul Bayt. يُوَاطِ إِسْمُهُ إِسْمِي وَإِسْمَ عَبِيهِ إِسْمَ عَبِي. His name will be the same as my name, and his father's name would be the same as my father's name. What will he come to do? يَمْلَعُ الْأَرْضَ قِسْطًا وَعَدْلًا كَمَا مُلِعَتُ ظُلْمًا وَجَوْرًا. He will come to fill the earth with justice and equality the way it would have been filled before that, with tyranny and injustice. Salawat Prophet Akbar. In Saudi Arabia, there is the organization known as Rabitat al-Alam al-Islami, World Muslim League. This is the world body of the Wahhabis, with its headquarters in Jeddah. And they have this service of, you know, publications, answering questions and things like that. In 1976, interestingly, somebody, a Sunni from Kenya, wrote a letter to them in Arabic about this issue of the ahadith of al-Mahdi. Are they authentic? Should we believe in them or not? And I'll just give you one paragraph of that answer, written in 1976 by Rabitat al-Alam al-Islami. نص الحفاظ والمحدثين محدثون على أن أحاديث المهدي فيها الصحيح والحسن ومجموعها متواتر مقطوع بتواتره وصحته. It says the scholars of hadith, they have written down the ahadith about Mahdi of all different kinds. Some of them are sahih, authentic. Some are good. And collectively, when you look at all these ahadith together, they write that it is mutawatir. Mutawatir is the highest quality of hadith, even above sahih. Means it has been quoted by so many companions that it is improbable to think that all of them sat together, conspired to come up with the same words. And so he's saying that when you look at the collection of this ahadith, they are mutawatir maqtu'u bitawatirihi. We are convinced that it is mutawatir. And then this is the important part. Inna al-i'tiqad bi khuruj al-mahdi. Wajibun, to believe in the appearance or coming of Mahdi is a wajib. Remember, they are not saying al-i'tiqad bi wiladati al-Mahdi. We are not saying that, you know, to believe that Mahdi would be born. They're talking about khuruj, the coming of Mahdi. To believe in it is a wajib. وعنه من عقائد أهل السنة والجماعة. This is the belief of أهل السنة والجماعة. ولا ينكره إلا جاهل بالسنة ومبتدئ في العقيدة. Nobody denies this belief in Mahdi unless he is ignorant of the Sunnah and an innovator in the belief system of Muslims. So those who do not deny it, according to the Wahhabis, they are either jahil or they are people who are creating fitna and bid'ah in the ummah. Third quotation, the final in this series. During our time among these Wahhabis, there was a very prominent alim of hadith known as Sheikh Nasiruddin Albani. He was an expert on hadith. All his works deals with all these, you know, ahadith, books of Ahl-Sunnah wal-Jama'ah. And according to some of the Sunni scholars, he was Bukhariyul Asr. Bukhariyul Asr, yani, just as Imam Bukhari had that prominence in the Sunni world because of his book Sahih Bukhari, during our time, he says, if you're looking for a Bukhari of our time, it is Nasiruddin Albani. He died in 70s or 90s, I'm not sure, but early. And he also, being an expert on the science of hadith, says, Amma mas'alatul mahdi. Coming to this issue of mahdi, فَلْيَعْلَمْ أَنَّ فِي خُرُوجِهِ أَحَادِيثٌ كَثِيرَةٌ صَحِيحَةٌ. He says that ahadith about his coming are many, many, and majority of them are sahiha. They are authentic. قِسْمٌ كَبِيرٌ مِنَهَا لَهُ أَسَادِينٌ صَحِيحَةٌ أَسَانِيدُ صَحِيحَةٌ. Many of them have very solid and strong chain of narrators. Then he ends by saying, خُلَاصَةُ الْقَوْلِ. He summarizes it by saying, إِنَّ عَقِيدَةُ خُرُوجِ الْمَهْدِي عَقِيدَةٌ صَابِتَةٌ مُتَوَاطِرٌ عَنْهُ صَلَّى اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِ وَآلِهِ وَسَلَّمُ. He says that the belief in coming of Mahdi is an established, well-known, you know, aqidah and belief from the Prophet himself. يَجِبُ الْإِيمَانُ بِهَا. It is necessary to have this belief in the coming of Mahdi. لِأَنَّهَا مِنْ أُمُورِ الْغَيْبِ. Because to believe in the coming of Mahdi is an example of ghayb. He says, إِنَّ الْإِيمَانَ بِهَا إِنَّ الْإِيمَانَ بِهَا مِنْ صِفَاتِ الْمُتَّقِينَ. He says, to believe in this Imam Mahdi is from the qualities of the righteous people. كما قال تعالى, as Allah has said, Alif Lam Mim, ذلك الكتاب لا ريب فيه هدى للمتقين الذين يؤمنون بالغيب. He is explaining this belief in Mahdi as one of the examples of believing in the ghayb that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has mentioned in the earlier ayat of Surah Baqarah. He ends by saying, وَإِنْ إِنَّ إِنْكَارَهَا لا يصدر إلا من جاهل أو مكابر. Rejecting this ahadith and belief in Mahdi cannot come to anyone unless he is ignorant or arrogant.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا
IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
Bankruptcies in Sweden increased for the seventh consecutive month in February, with retailers squeezed by declining household consumption, and the construction industry is struggling in the wake of an ongoing housing market rout. Sweden's economy is buckling under the weight of soaring consumer prices and increased borrowing costs. A recession may already be underway, as indebted households, whose mortgage rates are typically fixed for short periods, tighten purse strings, and a plunge in housing prices is rapidly reducing investments in new dwellings. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT wrote in this regard, bankruptcies in Sweden soared for the seventh consecutive month in February amid declining household consumption and growing pressure on construction companies from an ongoing housing market crunch, Bloomberg reported recently. A severe slump in Sweden's real estate sector has damaged the Nordic region's largest economy, which is struggling with surging consumer prices and growing interest rates. The country has been facing its worst housing price plunge in three decades, which has led to a reduction in investments in new dwellings. The situation has contributed to a surge in defaults in the country, according to the media outlet, citing Credit Reference Agency, UC. The number of bankruptcy filings in February jumped by 11% year-on-year. The retail and the motor vehicle trade industries were hit the hardest last month. UC economist Johanna Blum said in a statement, "The number of bankruptcies is still at a high level and has increased compared with last year," adding that there is little optimism ahead as more rate hikes are expected while inflation isn't slowing. In February, the largest Swedish company that declared bankruptcy was air carrier Air Leap, with annual sales of 278 million kronor, that is $27 million, Bloomberg said, citing Credit Safe. The Swedish government announced at the end of 2022 that the country was entering a recession that would last until 2025. The development reflects an EU-wide trend as the bloc teeters on the edge of a recession. In February, statistics agency Eurostat reported a wave of bankruptcies among EU businesses, which surged to the highest level in the fourth quarter of 2022 since records began in 2015. Defaults jumped by 26.8% compared to the previous 3 months, Eurostat said, noting that the number of bankruptcy declarations increased during all four quarters of 2022. The accommodation and food services industries were hit the hardest in the final 3 months of 2022 compared to the same period of 2019, with a 97.7% increase in insolvencies among EU businesses. High inflation and interest rate hikes will affect many Swedish households and slow down the country's economic growth next year, a leading bank said in a report published recently, Trend report citing Xinhua. Sweden's gross domestic product GDP growth is expected to be -1.1% next year, said Matthias Persson, Swedbank's chief economist and global head of macro research. in an interview with Swedish television SVT recently. The Swedish central bank's policy rate is expected to increase from the present 1.75% to 3% by February, according to Swedbank's latest economic outlook. It expects inflation and unemployment rate to reach 7.4% and 7.6% respectively in 2023. In consequence, Swedish households are expected to spend a higher proportion of their disposable income on mortgages since 1990s, a situation which Persson said would have a wider effect on the Swedish economy. Persson told SVT the labor market still shows resilience, but the situation is expected to worsen when employment-intensive industries such as retail and construction are affected. In its latest economic forecast, the European Commission said Swedish economy would be the worst performing in the EU in 2023. Recently, Statistics Sweden published a report showing that Sweden's gross domestic product decreased by 0.9% in the fourth quarter of 2022 compared with the third quarter. Jessica Engdahl, head of section at National Accounts Department, Statistics Sweden said, GDP contracted in the fourth quarter with a broad downturn in capital formation and household consumption. Compared with the previous quarter, gross fixed capital formation in the fourth quarter decreased by 0.8%. Exports went down by 1%, imports down by 1.1%, and market production shrank by 1.3%. Though the full-year GDP of 2022 increased by 2.4% from last year, several major banks have given negative predictions of Sweden's GDP this year. Swedbank expected a decline of 1.3%, SEB expected it to shrink by 1.2%, and Nordi, more pessimistic, forecast a 2% decline. The slowdown in economic activities also take a toll on households. Household final consumption decreased by 0.2% in the fourth quarter compared with the previous quarter, with decreased expenditure on furnishings and household equipment. Food and consumption abroad mainly contributed to the downturn. Households' real disposable income decreased by 2.7% compared with the fourth quarter of 2021. Mattias Persson, chief economist at Swedbank, told Swedish television, households will have a tough time. In his view, Riksbank, Sweden's central bank, needs to act more than previously thought because a very weak krona was also to blame. The chief economist added that the Swedish households took considerably more of a beating than those in the rest of Europe and the US, due partly to the krona weakened by the inflation shock and partly to the fact that Swedes are generally more indebted and more sensitive to interest rate increases. Swedbank forecasting housing prices to continue downward said, this in turn leads to the housing market in Sweden standing out as one of the hardest hits in the entire Western world right now. Earlier this month, the European Commission said in its winter 2023 economic forecast that Swedish economy would be the worst performing in the European Union in 2023, with an estimated decline of 0.8% this year.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on October 3rd, 2022, during the joint graduation ceremony for the cadets studying in the academies of the Islamic Republic of Iran's armed forces. The ceremony was held in Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba alayhi salam University of Office and Police Training. And the great movement to defend the Holy Shrine, both in social services and in scientific developments, as you can see, advancements in any scientific field are in fact made by the youth. They are the ones who drive this movement. Furthermore, we have seen in religious ceremonies, such as the Arba'in Walk, how millions of young Iranians traveled the path from Najaf to Karbala and how millions more walked inside the country itself. Those who could not attend the Arba'in Walk in that spiritual environment walked in different cities inside Iran instead. In the fields of production and innovation, as you can see on television, our youth are bringing something new to the country's manufacturing and industrial sectors. Every day, everywhere you look, you see the exceptional presence of young people there. Whether it is in dealing with an epidemic, in a religious aid movement, cultural work, or in relief projects during natural disasters such as floods, earthquakes, and the like. This young person is not going to despair. This young person is not going to detach himself or herself from his or her values. This young person is an inexhaustible force on the field. And of course, the young pious revolutionary youth have been leaders in all these fields. This is the current situation of our young people.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Well, with this point of view, if we look at your presence here, those who have gathered in the Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba alayhi salam University of Officer and Police Training, and also those who are hearing this speech in other universities, your presence and entry into the armed forces is a great asset. Your presence is a great asset. Of course, when it is alongside the experience of our veterans and the knowledge of the commanders. Strengthening the armed forces means strengthening the country. The armed forces are one of the strong pillars that strengthen the country. Of course, strengthening the country does not just depend on the armed forces. There are also other strong pillars. Scientific advancements are a source of the country's progress. The general faith of the people and the penetration of faith into people's hearts is a source of national strength.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics.